Okay, so Rhyme Tovim, I guess now that it's 12 p.m. in the East Coast and Erev Tov Aretz, for those who are joining from Israel and whatever other time zone you're joining from, a pleasure to have you. Welcome, everybody. And we're excited to start another, I'm sure it will be a wonderful series with Shuli Mishkin and her insight and her knowledge and her manner of presentation. We look forward to hearing over the next 8 weeks. And pleasure, Shuli, of course, is has a degree in Jewish history, graduate of Columbia University. He's been living in Israel for a long time, over 20 years.
A long
years,
time.
A long, long time. And it's really a pleasure to have her. And since, as for those who are early, I can't stay for the most of the shiur, just I'll make the announcements now. Tonight, of course, 8:30, Rabbi David Nachbar, who teaches at GPATS, at Stern, and at TABC, we're giving our parsha shiur, as I was mentioning. He's going to be talking about Noach, and says the discussion or debate between Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and Rav Yitzchak Hutner on humanism related to Noach. So that's tonight at 8:30. Tomorrow I have a continuing the shiur we started last week, a closer look at the Siddur. That's at 9:30 a.m. Eastern tomorrow. Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag begins a new series at 11:15 on the number 7, the biblical number 7. That's 11:15 on Sunday. And then we'll have our regular scheduled classes for next week. So we look forward to learning with you. Always look forward to your comments. And we always like the best when you invite a friend to join and give them a taste of what we do. So pleasure to see everybody. And with that, Shuli, Vavakasha, take it away.
All right. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. So nice starting a new year. And we are going to do the adventure of the next 8 weeks is going to be something that I'm actually really very excited about, because it's something that is not studied very well, is not studied very often. And that's the medieval time period in the land of Israel, meaning we know a lot about medieval Jewry in Europe. We talk about that a lot, but we don't talk about it so much in the land of Israel. Right? I'm going to just remind everybody that that questions go in the chat, please, and we will look at them at the end. So this is not a time period that is so well known. I'm going to stretch the medieval. You can ask five historians and they'll give you five definitions of what medieval means. For our purposes, we're going to be talking about the time period from a little bit after the Muslim conquest, right? The Muslims conquered the land of Israel in the 7th century. We're going to start a little bit later. And we are going to go up until the time of the Ottomans. So that's the basically big gadol. That's what we're going to be talking about. It's definitely less well known than, for example, earlier periods like First Temple times, certainly Second Temple times, Roman, Byzantine. That's very well studied and well visited when you come to Israel and you tour, as well as less well known than later times, right? 19th, 20th, 21st century modern Israeli history, which people are also fascinated by. This is a time period that's a little bit forgotten, right? So what we're going to take a look at over the course of 8 classes, what we're going to do today is largely background, okay? Not so much about Jewish history, but much more about kind of the general what's going on out there in the land of Israel at this time. After that, next week, we're going to start earlier. We're going to go a little bit earlier than the Crusades. We're going to talk about Tiberius, the Masoretes, the guys who make the vowelization and the ta'amim, the notes of the Torah reading. Very, very important. The Masoretes and the Paitanim, the poets of medieval Tiberius. That's going to be next week. After that, we're going to spend a little time with the Karaites. Right? We're going to talk about the Karaites and who opposes the Karaites and what is this whole, this whole movement. After that, we want to take a look at dreamers and rebuilders, people like Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the Ramban, right, Nachmanides, who are talk about the land of Israel, come back to the land of Israel. What do they do? Then we're going to take a look at the Maimonidean controversy, very, very important philosophical, but not only philosophical issue throughout Jewry, right? What do we think about the Rambam, about Maimonides, and about his philosophical works and what happened in the land of Israel, right, with that issue? Then we're going to go up to the mystics of Sfat. I'm just going to ask everybody to please not play with the annotating and the drawing. I know it's tempting, but don't. After that, we're going to take a look at what happens after the expulsion from Spain, right? The whole attempt to create redemption, Dona Gracia and her attempt to create an autonomous Jewish state, the Smicha controversy, all those different kinds of things. That's going to be our second to last class. And we're going to finally finish on not such a positive note, but that is the Shabtai Tzvi, which is a very important issue throughout the Jewish world, but certainly in the land of Israel. So the picture you're looking at, very, very famous picture. You've probably seen copies of it. We had a big copy of it by City Hall in Jerusalem. This is a great map, a medieval map of the land of the world, right? And besides all the great things like America off, you know, where the demons live and all the dragons and all those things, that's very good. But this is famous because it has the three continents of the known world, meaning America is not particularly important. This is from the 15th century, if I remember correctly, right? But the main continents, Europe, Africa, Asia, that's the known world. That's the civilized world. And who's in the center? Who is the crucible of everything? That's the land of Israel, right? And this, of course, is an approach that Chazal have, where they talk about the world as an eye, and the land of Israel is the pupil in the eye, right? And Jerusalem is the pin dot of light in the middle of the pupil. So this idea of the land of Israel, which geographically, this is not so off, by the way, the land of Israel is a land bridge between the different continents, but it's also much more important on a metaphorical, spiritual level. And that's going to be what we're talking about with the Crusades. The Crusades bring the land of Israel back to the center of the world, right, where we always thought it was, but it lost that standing for a little while. So let's take a look. This is a large timeline. Don't worry, every class we're going to go back and do a more specific timeline, but this is kind of just to give us a larger picture. What I left out of this timeline, which we'll talk about next week because it's the time period of the people of Tveria, of the Masoretes, I left out the time of the Muslim conquest and those first centuries of the early Muslims, right? The Umayyads, the Abbasids, we'll talk about that next time. But we're going to start with the Crusades. Okay? 1095, Pope Urban in Clermont preaches the first crusade. Thousands upon thousands, as we're going to see, start heading off to the land of Israel with, unfortunately, stops in various Jewish communities along the way and attacks on Jewish communities along the way. But they finally reach Jerusalem. Jerusalem is captured relatively quickly. Terrible, terrible massacre of anybody not Christian. Jerusalem becomes empty of Jews and of Muslims. And then we have the first 88 years, the real victory of the Crusaders, right? Those first 88 years are when the Crusaders are ruling most of the land, not everything, but most of the land. In between, we have a little blip of the Second Crusade, not in the land of Israel, but north in Edessa. But then, of course, it all comes crashing down in 1187. The Crusaders are defeated by a Muslim coalition headed by Saladin at the Horns of Hattin in the north. After 4 years, the Crusaders come back. The Third Crusade, Richard the Lionheart comes. But he only takes part of the land. And from that point, for the next 100 years, the land of Israel is split between Crusaders and Muslims. Okay? Jerusalem remains in Muslim hands, except for this very short little 15-year period. And the coast is mostly in Crusader hands. We're going to see the map. Don't worry. But the beginning of the end for the Crusaders is when Saladin and his soldiers, right, his Ayyubid dynasty, are basically replaced by a new group called the Mamluks. Okay? And they are headed by a very fearsome leader named Baibars. And Baibars is the one who not only kicks out the Mongols who come to the land of Israel, something that we don't pay so much attention to because we're thinking about the Crusaders, but he gets rid of the Crusaders, right? Gets rid of the Crusaders, starts to rebuild inland, has a huge effect on the way the land of Israel will look for hundreds of years afterwards. In the midst of all of this Muslim retaking of the land of Israel, the Ramban, Nachmanides, comes to Jerusalem. Eventually he goes to Akko. Crusader kingdom falls completely. The last stand, Akko, Atlit, in the 1290s. And that's the end of the Crusaders, right? From that point on, the Mamluks are in control until the Ottomans come along in 1517, right? Like I said, don't worry if it didn't get, if you didn't get everything, we're going to come back to different things as we go along. But first, there's something that is very pervasive. I would even call it a Zionist myth, which is that the land was empty of Jews from the time of Bar Kokhba until Bilu meaning the first Aliyah in the 1880s, right? And a lot of us may have learned this in school. And in fact, there's even this very famous Zionist saying, right? The people without a land will come to the land without a people. Okay, forget that. That's ignoring the Arabs who are here. But there were Jews here as well, okay? Jews did stay on. The land of Israel was not the center anymore, okay? It doesn't rule Jewry, but there still are Jews living here, right? And there still is a significance to the land of Israel for two reasons. Number one, there are points in time where movements come out of the land of Israel. Most famously, we would say the Kabbalists of Sfat, right, in the 16th century. It's not a very large group of people, but it is a group of people and a philosophy and a spirituality that affects Judaism till today. Okay? So there are movements that come from the land of Israel, even when we are numerically small, that have significance. Besides that, the land of Israel, there could be no Jews living here. It still will be significant. It still will be important. When we talk about the Karaites, we're also going to talk about Rav Sadia Gaon and the fight over the calendar. Right? Who gets to be the ones who determine when there's a leap year? Is it going to be the land of Israel or is it going to be Babylonia? Babylonia is where the scholars are, is where the great yeshivot are, but the land of Israel is still the land of Israel. You cannot take away the primacy of the land of Israel. So there is still significance to the land. And there are communities here. So one of the concepts that we have about medieval land of Israel is that there are these four cities, right? Four holy cities. Now, they are holy, meaning we're talking about Jerusalem and Hebron. There is significance to these cities. However, there are other holy cities, right? Shiloh is holy. Beit El is holy. Why these particular ones, besides Jerusalem, of course, which makes it onto anybody's list? Because this is where Jews stayed in most cases, okay? Yes, there was an earthquake in Sfat, they had to leave. Yes, the Crusaders kicked the Jews out or murdered them in Jerusalem, they had to leave. But in general, these are the cities that Jewish communities flourished in and continued. And I happen to love this map. I always, whenever I show this map, I say it's not a good map to drive by. Okay? Don't use it instead of Waze, but it's a very fun map just to look at and to get a sense of what's important, you know, in each of these places. So of course we have Jerusalem. Right, Jerusalem with the mountains, with the area of where the temple should be. We have Hebron with the Cave of the Patriarchs, with Ma'arat HaMachpelah. Right? We have Tiberia down by the water and the grave of Rabbi Meir Bal Hanes and Rabbi Akiva. And of course, we have Tzfat high up on the mountain. An easy way to remember these cities. Not a lot of people like this trick. It's very nice. If you know the ancient world, right, the Greeks divided, believed that everything came from four elements, right? If you know your 70s rock groups, you know those four elements: earth, wind, fire, and air, right? I don't know where air went. And each one of them connects to one of these cities, right? So earth, of course, is Hebron, the graves, the first purchase of land by a Jew in the land of Israel, Abraham. Water, of course, is Tveria, the Kinneret. Jerusalem is fire, the temple, the Shekhinah, all those different things. And Sfat is air because it's high up on the mountain, because people have their head in the clouds, however you want to look at it. Okay, so that's just to get a little sense. Somebody asked, I just looked quickly at the chat because I cheated, that when did the Jews return? It's not that the Jews returned, because it's not that the Jews left. Okay, yes, many Jews did leave. Many Jews did go into exile, but there is never a situation where there are no Jews in the land of Israel. Hey, we're going to see that there is return, there is aliyah, there are people coming and waves, but there is not a situation where, you know, the last Jew out closes the lights and shuts the door. There's always Jews who are here. Some people may remember the old Diaspora Museum, the Beit HaTfutzot in Tel Aviv, where they had an exhibit about the Zinati family in Pekin. You can still go to Pekin and meet the last scion of this family, Margalit Zinati, and they claim that they never left land, and they're the only family that has an unbroken chain from Second Temple times until today. And that's very likely that that's true. But it doesn't mean that they're the only ones who stayed. Jews stayed in various places, and there were all, it was always some form of a Jewish community. Okay, so now that we've gotten that out of the way, let's talk a little bit about the Crusades. I think for most of us who have a little bit of a knowledge of Jewish history, you say the Crusades, you have a very visceral reaction. You say, ooh, Crusades. And you look at that picture and you say that that's a terrible, terrible, terrible time in Jewish history. And you are right, but you are also wrong, meaning there were terrible massacres, particularly in Europe on the way to the land of Israel. And it was a very, very dark period for European Jewry. And we know this from the Baalei Tosfot and from the families who lived in Germany and the Rhineland. And we have keynote that talk about this. And it was a very dark period. In the land of Israel, when the Crusaders come, there also is terrible bloodshed. By the way, not just of Jews. There's just bloodshed everywhere. The Crusades are an incredibly brutal time, both on the Christian side and on the Muslim side. But what happened afterwards, after things kind of settled down, is that the Crusades open up the land of Israel in a way that it hadn't been for hundreds upon hundreds of years. And that's what I mean when I say, how did the Crusades change the world? So first of all, up until the Crusades, for the hundreds of years after the Byzantine Empire falls and the Muslims are in charge, the land of Israel does not have particular significance. It's part of the larger Muslim empire. The Crusades bring the land of Israel back to be the focal point of the world. This is going to be its own empire, the Kingdom of Jerusalem, right? We're going to be here. We're going to fight. This is the place we want to get to. It's not that we're just one little piece of a larger empire. So making the focal point be the land of Israel. It's a connection to Western Europe. There's a population influx, not just of the Crusaders, but afterwards of other people, particularly Jews, pilgrimage, aliyah, because the sea routes are open. Once the Crusaders come and they rule the cities of the coast, there's more opportunity for people to come, and people includes Jews. And we're going to see that as we go along. There's economic growth. There's a lot of building. Hey, and the land of Israel becomes the focal point of the Western world. Now, it doesn't mean that everything is great, but it does mean that there are certain things that we have to be aware of that do come out, especially in the land of Israel, as positive results of the Crusades. So let's go back to the beginning. Why did they come, right? What's the story behind the Crusades? So at this point, just to review your Christian medieval history a little bit, right? By this point, the church has split. There's an Eastern church with its capital in Constantinople, right, in Istanbul. And there's the Western church in Europe, in Rome. They are split from each other, but of course they still have relationships with each other. And in 1095, the Byzantines turn to the Pope and they say, could you come and help us? We are besieged by the Muslims. We need help. And the Pope, Pope Urban, goes to Clermont and he preaches a Crusade, but somehow the focus changes. And instead of saying, let's go to Constantinople to save the church there, he says, let's go to Jerusalem to save the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is what you see here on the left, because of course the Muslims are ruling in Jerusalem. In general, the Christians have more or less religious freedom, right? They're second class citizens, but like the Jews, they have religious freedom. But there are rumors that the church is being attacked, that the church is being desecrated. So that's really what happens. In the end of November 1095, he says, we have to go and we have to save Jerusalem. Now, there is, of course, a religious element here, right? There's anybody who discounts religion as a cause of history is very, very mistaken. People tried to do that about 20 years ago, and it came back to slap them in the face with ISIS and the Taliban and all the other radical Muslims. So there definitely is a religious motivation going on here, but not only. Okay, at this point in European history, the most powerful kingdom in Europe is the church. Okay, the church is more powerful than any single king, and this is a way to consolidate that power, to bring together crusaders from all different countries, all under the banner, under the rubric of the church. So it makes the church even stronger than it was before. It makes more of a unity, reuniting perhaps the Eastern and the Western Church. There's a feeling of the end of days, right? And this is the picture that we have here on the right. Okay, this is a medieval painting of a fellow named Peter the Hermit, who by all accounts was a disgusting person. And he kind of gathered together a whole rabble to take with him on the People's Crusade. You had all these knights, you had all these nobles and princes and kings, and you also had this kind of groundswell movement from the bottom, people coming who, let's say, were not the choicest members of society. Okay. The Crusades was a very good way to get rid of a lot of testosterone from Europe. Okay. Remember all those stories about King Arthur and knights and chivalry. What's going on there? And what's going on there is like this. You are a lord of a manor. You have five sons. Only one son is getting that land because you don't want to split up your land among five sons, because the next generation will be split up among 25 grandsons and the next generation after that. You pass it on to the oldest, or the one you like best, or the only legitimate one, or whatever it is. What happens to all the rest of those sons? One of them can go into the church and become a priest, right? One of them might become a merchant, but some of them are going to get on their horses, put on their armor, and go off gallivanting around the countryside being knights errant and looking for good deeds to do. And that's a big danger. You don't want all these young men with no money and no ties to be gallivanting around the countryside. Let's ship them off somewhere where they can do their fighting somewhere else. So there are a lot of elements going on here, religious, political, practical, millennial. Why are you joining, right? I told it to you from the perspective of the people who are leaving, right? Who are running this. This is why we should have this. But what about the people who are joining? Why are you joining? Well, first of all, you should, I remember, Americans may remember this, right? There was a slogan, join the Marines and see the world, right? That's exactly what this is. Most people in the medieval world travel a radius, somebody wrote about this once, I don't remember exactly, but something like 10 to 15 kilometers from their birthplace their entire life. You don't go anywhere, right? There's nowhere you're going to go. Maybe if you're a merchant, you go to the trade fairs in the big city. Jews, Dafka, traveled more than Christians. But you're not going anywhere. This is a chance to see the world, okay? You also have religious fervor. You're fighting heresy. And also, very, very important, the church promises two things. Number one, if you go off on the crusade and you are killed, you will go directly to heaven. No, do not stop, go. Do not collect $100, right? You, whatever sins you may have committed, they will all be atoned by fighting in the crusades. That's a very big deal. It also gives you a sense of the kind of people who might join such a thing, right? The other thing, a much more earthly concern, and this is where it becomes important to Jews, all of your debts are forgiven. Who are the people who are most likely owed money in medieval Europe? Jews, because the Jews are the moneylenders. Your debts are forgiven. You don't have to pay back that moneylender. So you should go. It's a very great incentive to go off and to fight in the crusade. Okay, so we have reasons from the leadership, we have reasons from the people, a lot of reasons to go, even though the likelihood of you being killed or at best maimed or falling terribly ill is really very great. But you go, right? So they gather together from all over. They gather near Constantinople. We don't know exact numbers, but the estimates are somewhere between 60 and 100,000 people. This, of course, is after going through the Rhineland and all the stories that happened there. And then they make their way through Asia Minor from the north towards the land of Israel. They go down, they capture Ramla, and they get to Jerusalem in June of 1099. And they besiege the city from June 7th to July 15th. It's a pretty long siege. Okay? The head of the siege is this fellow over here on the right, Godfrey of Bouillon. There are actually some very interesting Jewish legends about him and how he goes and he talks to Rabbeinu Tam. And we have all kinds of interesting stories. Likely is that none of them ever happened, but they are interesting to hear about. Right? But he's the guy who besieges Jerusalem. Where does he launch his siege from? Where does he launch his attack from? From the northeastern corner of the city. Today, where the Rockefeller Museum is, if people are familiar, right, a little further past Damascus Gate. And the major tower here is this tower, which is called in Arabic Burj al-Laqlaq, or the Stork Tower. And the legend behind it is that the crest of Godfrey of Bouillon was a swan, but the Arabs confused the swan, the stork, and they called it the Stork Tower. In any case, he storms the city July 1099. The Arabs, the Muslims, and the Jews, by the way, the Jews at this point, the Jewish quarter of the city at this point is in the northern part of the city. So they're actually the population that is attacked first. And they are the ones who are very heavily involved in defense, but it doesn't work, right? It doesn't work. The Crusaders capture Jerusalem. We have horrific stories of the Jews being shut up in the synagogues, the Muslims in the mosques, and the whole place being torched. And the city becomes empty of Jews and Muslims. But the rest of the conquest also happens very quickly. The Muslims are fragmented. We're going to see Saladin unites two different dynasties, the Fatimids and the Abbasids, right? But before that, they're very fragmented. They're not expecting attacks from the coast, and everything falls. So you have this very large Kingdom of Jerusalem. Now we're going to see Kingdom of Jerusalem is going to be used a little bit later in history in a kind of a way that doesn't make much sense. But here it really is the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is part of it. They have access to the sea, which is very important for supplies. They also have access from the north, Edessa, Antioch, Tripoli, very important. They're not a huge population in the land of Israel. Remember, out of those 60 to 100,000 people, some of them are left behind here, and some are left behind here, and some are left behind here, and some are killed in battle. You don't have huge numbers. So what they do to take advantage of the fact that there are not so many of them, but they need to control a large area, is they build fortresses on high places that have an amazing view. Okay, this is actually Monfort in the Western Galilee. But anywhere you're going to find a place that has a really great view, chances are good that the Crusaders came and built something there. And we'll give a few examples in a minute. Who are these guys? So we have different orders. Probably the most famous ones are the Knights Templar, not to be confused with the Templars, right? Some people may be familiar with the German Templars from the German colony, Emek Rephaim. 19th century, totally different people, obviously the same root temple, but different guys. The Knights Templar are a very elite fighting order. They're called the Order of Solomon's Templar. Their headquarters are on the Temple Mount. They're very skilled fighters. They become so powerful that ultimately they are disbanded in the early 14th century by the church, and they become very mysterious. And that's why you have all kinds of ridiculous stories like the Da Vinci Code about them, right? Because they become very mysterious, but they really are very, very militarily powerful as well as economically powerful. And they're very tied to Jerusalem because their headquarters are on the Temple Mount. Another very important order is these guys over here. On the right, and that's the Hospitallers, or the Knights of St. John. As you can tell from their name, Hospitallers, hospital, they nurse the sick and the injured, of which there are many. And this memorial here is set up in the Christian quarter in an area that's right near the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's called the Moristan. It's a relatively more modern marketplace that was made in the 19th century. The name is a strange name, Moristan. What does it mean? It's Persian for hospital. And we know from Crusader Chronicles that the Hospitallers built a massive hospital right there near the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Presumably, you know, if you die, there's a priest right nearby, right, for last rites. Now, up until 10 years ago, we only knew about this hospital from literary sources. But then there was a renovation that was being done by the city in this area, and they actually found this hospital. They found it underground. It's not open to the public, but it exists and it's there, right? The Moristan of the Hospitallers. Eventually they have to leave the land of Israel. Some of them go to Malta. And that's why you have this cross, right? The Maltese cross down here is also the cross of the Knights of St. John. So those are two of the very famous knightly orders. There are others as well. Okay. And like we said, the Crusaders build these fortresses we're going to see not only, meaning they're in Akko, that's a city in Caesarea, but even when they're in cities, their cities are built like fortresses. It's a walled complex that includes everything that you need, right? You have places to eat, you have places to sleep, you have a church to pray in, you have a crypt where people are buried, you have a prison for the crusaders who misbehave, right? You have a courtyard, and of course you have guard posts, and this is how they set these up. They take the best lookout points, whether it's on main roads, right? We have Crusader fortresses, Latrun, right? On the road today from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the Castel, same area, Nebi Samuel, Monjoy, right? Also the approach to Jerusalem. You have them in the Galil, okay? This is the Chiam fortress over here in the Galil. There's also, we're going to see in Sfat. This on the left here is called Belvoir or Kochav HaYarden, and it's on the eastern border, right? In the Jordan Valley. So all the areas that you want to protect, the roads, the north, the borders, the sea, they're building these massive fortresses in order to preserve their strength. Okay? Now, of course, the sea is super important because that's where your supply lines are. The Crusaders are a land army. When they first come to the land of Israel, they don't come by the sea. They come overland to Constantinople and then overland to the land of Israel. But they realize that they need the sea. And for that, they have to bring in soldiers, Christians who had not been involved beforehand. And that's the Italians, right? The Venetians are involved and various other Italians there, the sailors, and they control the coast because the coast is super important in order to get to have supply lines open. And we have very significant Crusader cities along the coast, whether it's Jaffa or Ashkelon or Caesarea or Akko, of course, is one of the most important ones. I brought you two pictures here. The picture on the right here is of Crusader Caesarea, right? We're familiar with Caesarea, Caesarea as Herod's city and then a Roman city and a Byzantine city. The Crusader city is much smaller. It's surrounded by a wall, like we said before. This is the moat outside. It's still a very formidable city, but it's much, much smaller than the Roman city. The other picture is a picture from Ashkelon. Now, Ashkelon is a fascinating place because it passes back and forth, Crusaders, Muslims, Crusaders, Muslims. And in the excavations that were done there, okay, we see the walls of Ashkelon that were basically pushed into the sea by the Muslims. And this is a piece of wall that was discovered. This was published in National Geographic about 10 years ago. And as you can see, it's got underneath Arabic writing, right? Can you see the Arabic writing in the background? And along came a crusader and said, well, I'm here now. And he carved his heraldic crest on top of the Arabic writing, right? It's graffiti. It's saying, you're not here anymore. I'm here now, right? And it's a great wordless example of this battle back and forth. Now, what's actually fascinating is that an Israeli researcher, an Israeli medieval historian, actually went to England, found this crest, which belongs to a family that still exists today. And he found out who the knight was because they had a family lore about this knight that went off to the Crusades. And his name was Hugh of Wake. And Hugh of Wake is the graffiti artist. So I love that story. So the Crusaders are doing very well. They're very strong. They're thriving. But then they are attacked by the Muslims. What happens to change things is this fellow over here, this statue over here. And this is Salah ad-Din, or Saladin, as he's often said in English. He lives from 1137 to 1193, and he founds a new dynasty. It's called the Ayyubid dynasty. And what's significant about him, and this is, by the way, why Saladin is still invoked in the Muslim world today, is he unites the various empires. Okay, he takes the Fatimids of Egypt, he takes the Abbasids of Syria, he brings them together in order to get rid of these Christians, right? And that's why you'll hear about, you know, the greater Arab world and the greater Arab empire, and they'll invoke Saladin because that's exactly what he does. He unites everybody to get rid of the Crusaders. And he comes to the land of Israel, and in the spring of 1187, he attacks the Crusaders from the north and from the east. Now, this is one of the most famous battles, certainly in the land of Israel. The Horns of Hattin, which you can see here with the Kinneret and the Golan in the background. This is very close to Tiberias, to Tveria. What happens is the Crusaders gather in Tsipori, which is about a 15-minute drive from Tveria today. Hey, Tsipori is a very good place to gather. There's springs there. There's water. Hey, that's something that's essential. They gather, they have 18, according to their records, 18,000 infantry, right, foot soldiers, and 1,200 horsemen. Hey, Saladin and his men gather by the south of the Kinneret. We don't know the number of foot soldiers, but we know that the number of horsemen is 10 times what the Crusaders have. Crusaders have 1,200. The Muslims have 12,000. Okay, so it's incredible imbalance of numbers. On July the 2nd, Saladin moves north to Tveria. He besieges the Crusader city of Tveria, and that's where the Crusaders make their fatal mistake. They leave Tsipori, which has water, and they start to march towards Tiberias to save the Crusaders of Tiberias. But it's July in the land of Israel, in Tiberias, which is a very hot place, and they have no water. Okay, so they're already at a huge disadvantage even before the battle begins. There's a terrible, terrible battle here at Karnei Chitim overlooking Tveria. The Crusader army is completely decimated. The few that are left alive pay money to Saladin, pay a ransom to be able to escape. Jerusalem becomes Muslim again. The only Christians left in the land are the Eastern Christians, or the ones who were there before the Crusaders came in. It's an incredible, incredible defeat. And you can see 1190, here we are. Look at this map on the left. This is 3 years after Saladin. Okay, the only thing that is still held by the Crusaders in the area near the land of Israel is this little area of Tripoli and of Antioch. Okay, things are very bad for the Crusaders. All of this is Muslim. Saladin establishes control, reestablishes control over absolutely everything, but the Crusaders do not give up, and they raise a third crusade. Okay? And you can see, we'll talk about that in a second, but just take a look at the map for a minute. By 1200, okay, the third crusade begins in 1191. By 1200, they don't have a huge empire, okay, but they've managed to retake the coast. Right? They've managed to retake the coast, and that from that point on, the land of Israel is divided between the Crusaders and the Muslims. But what happens there? Okay, so probably the most famous figure of the Third Crusade is Richard the Lionheart, famous to most of us probably from Robin Hood, where he's portrayed as the good and the wise king who goes away and his evil brother John and blah, blah, blah. Richard the Lionheart was a horrible, horrible person. There's nothing to say in his merit unless you're on the side of the Crusaders and you're happy that he took back the land of Israel. But he was incredibly cruel. He massacred people after making treaties with them. He was not a good guy. However, he was a good soldier. Right? And after defeating all sorts of internal enemies to become king, including his own father, by the way, Henry II, very soon after he is crowned king, he leaves for the crusade, okay? And he comes and he takes Akko, and he very, very cruel, but he manages to take these areas back. Now, in terms of the Jews, some people here, I don't know if I have any British people who have joined in, but some people here may recognize this, this picture here on the right. This is called Clifford's Tower in York. This is a very famous, terrible place in Jewish history. When Richard is crowned in 1189, Jews are attacked. There are terrible anti-Jewish attacks because Jews come to pay tribute to the new king, and people say Jews are not allowed in at the coronation, and they're attacked. And soon after that, there are massacres of Jews in various places in England, and probably the most famous one is in York, okay, where the Jews take refuge in this tower, hoping that the local leadership will save them, but the mob comes and attacks. And we have this unfortunately many times, a terrible story of the Crusades, where many of the Jews do not even wait for the Crusaders to come and kill them, but actually commit suicide. At that point, the mob sets the tower on fire, and whoever has not committed suicide is killed. And it's a terrible, terrible tragedy. We actually have a kina about it, right, on Tisha B'Av, about the Jews of York, about the pogrom, the massacre in York. So Richard the Lionhearted, definitely, I don't care how much you like Robin Hood, not somebody for Jews to have too much sympathy for. However, he does take back part of the land. And here's where we get this kind of a strange title, almost an oxymoronic title, which is Akko on the coast, is the capital of the kingdom of Jerusalem. They don't have Jerusalem. They have a kingdom of Jerusalem. Okay? And Akko becomes the capital, and Akko becomes a very significant city, a very actually counterintuitively multicultural, cosmopolitan city, a lot of different types of crusaders, but other people as well, because the crusaders who come and survive and settle down, they get married. Who are they marrying? They're marrying local women, right? Whether Christians who are Arab Christians or sometimes Muslims as well. So Akko becomes a very multicultural city, and Jews come to Akko as well. We'll see that. It's unlike Crusader Jerusalem, where Jews are not allowed. Akko, Jews are allowed to live there, and we're going to see that it becomes a very significant community. And at this point, from 1191 until 1291, this 100 years of Crusader rule of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, the country is split in two. Jerusalem remains for the most part Muslim, except, like we said, for this very short blip of time. The coast is Christian. You have two different groups that are living in different places. So let's go back to our Crusaders for a moment before we are going to get rid of them for good. And one of the very significant developments that happens when the Crusaders are here, and this happens relatively late, 1217, is you have a group of a Christian order called the Franciscans. Okay, the Franciscans, who are led by St. Francis of Assisi, that's him over here, okay, who actually comes to the land of Israel. And they come and they establish, it's a monastic order, and they establish themselves as what are called Custodia Terra Sancta, the custodians of the Holy Land. And the Franciscans are the ones who take control of the Christian holy sites. Okay? They are the caretakers. Later on, they become archaeologists. And even when the Crusaders are kicked out, the Franciscans often stay on. And when Christians are allowed back or rebuild certain places like Jaffa, like Ein Karim in Jerusalem, the Franciscans are the ones who are at the forefront. Again, not great lovers of Jews, but very significant in terms of rebuilding the land. Perhaps more interesting for us, because they're the custodians of the holy sites, they also become archaeologists. And the Franciscans know an awful lot about the land and about the history and about the archaeology. Obviously, they're looking at it through their own lens, but they are very fascinated by archaeology. And today, the Franciscan, one of the Franciscan centers on the Via Dolorosa in Jerusalem, the two churches that are there, there's an amazing museum of archaeology that the Franciscan archaeologists have dug out. So that they're interesting. They also are the ones that if you're a Christian tourist and you come to the land, you're going to go to the Franciscans, because they're the ones who are going to show you where to go and give you shelter and help you around. And another place in Jerusalem run by the Franciscans is the Casa Nova, not Casanova the lover, but Casa Nova, the new house. And it's a hostel for Christian pilgrims under the auspices of the Franciscans. But our time with the Crusaders is coming to a close. And basically what happens is that they are going to be kicked out by a new dynasty. Saladin and his Ayyubid dynasty are very powerful. They're very useful to get rid of the Crusaders, but they also are fragmented, infighting, falling apart. And the new dynasty that comes along, that we're going to talk about for a couple of minutes, the Mamluks are the ones who come and take the land back and get rid of the Crusaders once and for all. Before we get to who they are, something else that's significant, okay, the Mamluks are coming from Egypt. They are fighting off not only the Crusaders, but another group coming from Asia called the Mongols. Right? The Mongols, we think of Genghis Khan. We don't think of them so much in the land of Israel, but they do come to the land of Israel. They're coming in from the north. They're about to attack and to take the land of Israel. And before the Mamluks are dealing with the Crusaders, they are dealing with the Mongols. And there's a major battle at Ein Jalut, which we call Ein Harod, Mayan Harod. And they're defeated and they're kicked out. And once they get rid of the Mongols, they're ready to take on the Crusaders and bring the land of Israel back to the Muslims. So just a very short digression. Who are these guys? So the Mamluks are actually fascinating. Unlike all the other dynasties, Muslim dynasties that we've had until this point, okay, who are Arabs, who are Muslims, the Mamluks were neither. Okay, they are actually slaves who are captured over here in the steppes, right, in Kazakhstan, in Mongolia, the same places that the Mongols really are coming from, right? They are captured as children. They are brought to the Muslim Empire, and they are trained as child soldiers, okay? And they are absolutely loyal to their Muslim masters. They're trained to be incredibly competent and fierce warriors, but they're also converted to Islam. So they become very devout Muslims. Okay? And once they control Jerusalem, we're going to see when we talk about Jerusalem in Mamluk times, they build mosques and madrasas. They're very involved in creating religious buildings. Okay, so they're very fierce warriors. They're very fierce Muslims. But at a certain point, they rebel against their rulers, and they take over. And the fiercest Mamluk of all, the one who leads the dynasty and who comes and gets rid of the crusaders, is somebody named Baybars. And now Baybars means panther. Okay, and that's why everywhere Baybars is, you have a nice picture of a panther, which is, by the way, what is on, I think I put it in this picture here. Sorry to go back. Yeah, here is the same panther, but I should have put the picture of the gate. This is what's on Lion's Gate. It's not a lion. It's a panther. Okay, and it's the symbol of Baybars. He's the panther. He is very powerful. In 1260, he defeats the Mongols and he becomes the Sultan. And at that point, he starts to take over to get rid of the crusaders one by one. He starts on the coast. He moves inland. The final place to fall are in the northern coast, Akko and Atlit. Okay? And he takes the crusader cities one by one. And what he does, which is fascinating and has an incredible impact on the history of the land of Israel for the next few centuries, is he destroys the cities of the coast. Okay, what Saladin did not do, Baybars chooses to do. He conquers Ashkelon and he conquers Jaffa and he conquers Caesarea and eventually he conquers Akko. And he says, I don't want those crusaders to return from Europe. How am I going to keep them from returning? I'm going to destroy their access on the coast. I'll build fortresses in the east, but in the west, they won't be able to sail in because there will be no harbors. There will be no cities. Now, he's very aware that these cities are thriving, beautiful cities. He even writes about destroying Ashkelon, which is the picture that you see over here on the right, the walls of the Crusader walls of Ashkelon, that how his heart was broken to destroy this beautiful city. Hey, but he does. He just kind of sends these cities into the sea. And what happens, and this is why I'm saying it has a huge impact on the land of Israel, is from this point, from the late 13th century till the 17th, 18th, and sometimes even 19th century, these cities remain destroyed. The land of Israel, the population moves inland towards the mountain. The coast is much, much less important. This has a huge impact on Zionism, right? Why? Because when the Jews start coming back to the land in the late 19th, early 20th century, and they want to buy land, the only land that's available to them is the land that nobody wants. Nobody wants the coast. It's garbage. It's swampy. It's destroyed. That's why Tel Aviv is on the coast. Hey, nobody wants the Jezreel Valley. It's swampy. It's diseased. So the land of Israel develops, the Zionist land of Israel develops along the coast, across the Jezreel Valley, also areas of the Galilee that nobody wants. And it takes a very long time to settle in these areas of the mountains because this is where the Muslim strongholds are. But the coast, much less important. So Baybars has a huge effect on the history of the land of Israel and on the history of Zionism as well. One of the last places, Akko and Atlit kind of tie for the last place. But Akko is one of the last stands. The Templars tunnel underneath the walls in order to get out. And there's attempts to escape. The walls are destroyed, as you can see here. These are the remains, some of the remains of the Crusader walls in Akko. Very fascinating discovery from a couple of years ago. Someone found a shipwreck in Haifa Bay. And in the shipwreck, they found a whole bunch of these gold florins, which are Crusader coins, right? And coins are wonderful because you know their date, right? So these coins are from the late 13th century. And what we think is that this is a ship of Crusaders who were trying to escape and were shot down or whatever happened, but the ship sank. And that was the end of that, right? And Akko is destroyed and it's only rebuilt by the Ottomans, by Dar al-Omar in the 18th century. It takes a very long time for Akko to be rebuilt. We're going to come back to Akko when we talk about the Ramban, but that's just to give us a larger picture. Now, what the Muslims do, which is the same thing that the Christians did before them, right? And what most conquerors do is they Islamicize with a vengeance. Okay. They take churches and they turn them into mosques. And they do this all over the country. Okay. So for example, if you go to Ramla, Ramla has this incredible, incredible mosque, the Great Mosque of Ramla. It's actually the largest Crusader church in the land of Israel. And you can see from the architecture, right? This is clearly a Crusader church, but you put in a prayer corner and you put down prayer mats and it becomes a mosque, but it starts out as a Crusader church. Okay? Another site you can see here on the right. This is called the Cenaculum or the Room of the Last Supper on Mount Zion in Jerusalem, a place that's very important to Christians. But when the Muslims take over Jerusalem, they build a mihrab. They build a prayer niche in this Room of the Last Supper. Okay? And they do this everywhere. You can see it in, I put it on, I'm sorry if I'm making you dizzy, but I put it in the picture here, right? This is on the right here. This is a church of St. Anne on the Via Dolorosa in Jerusalem. And you can see it's a church, but it has a big Muslim inscription because this very, very impressive Crusader church was turned into a madrasa, was turned into a Muslim study hall. Nebi Samuel, okay, on the left here, Nebi Samuel, which was a very significant Crusader fortress, Crusader church, crypt, okay, the place where people go and daven at the kever of Shmuel HaNavi is the Crusader crypt of the church. The Muslims come along and they build a minaret, they build a mosque here. So they do this everywhere, and they turn the land of Israel back into a Muslim place. There are still Christians. Okay? The Muslims are more tolerant than the Crusaders were. There still is a small Christian community in Jerusalem and in other places, but there is very much an Islamicization of the country. Okay? In Sfat, place where the Crusaders built a massive fortress, Baibars comes along and builds an even bigger fortress. Right? It's the largest fortress in the whole area. It's enormous. There's not so much of it left today because of the earthquake that happened in Sfat over the years. But basically, what the Mamluks build in Sfat determines the city of Sfat. But the Crusaders and the Mamluks determined the way the old city of Sfat looks today, right? If you've ever been to Sfat, you know the streets all go in a circle as you go down the hill, right? And that's because there were moats, and the moats were filled in and became the streets around the castle, the fortress at the top of the hill. The title here is not my title. It's a great title. Dr. Chagi Amitzur, How Baibars Helped Write the Shulchan Aruch. Basically, what Baibars and the Mamluks do, this is a classic Mamluk building in Sfat, is they come to Sfat, they build it up, they make it a safe place to move to, the economy begins to thrive. And so in the 15th and the 16th century, when Jews start to come, expellees from Spain start to come to the land of Israel, Sfat is a great place for them, right? And that's where you get the fascinating community of Sfat that we're going to talk about in one of the last classes. But if it wasn't for Baibars, who knows if Rav Yosef Karo would have come to settle in Sfat and the Ari and all the other greats of Sfat. And we'll finish up with a little bit about Jerusalem. When they return to Jerusalem, same thing like with the coast. We don't want those guys to come back. So we have to protect the city more than it was protected before. So you have the Muslim quarter here. And basically what the Mamluks do is they raise this area of the Muslim quarter to the height of the Temple Mount. And if you've ever been in the Kotel tunnels, in the Western Wall tunnels, and they've explained to you why there are tunnels. There are tunnels because the Mamluks build these massive arches And then they build their houses on top. They raise the street level of the Muslim quarter so as to protect the Temple Mount. So there'll be less resistance as people come and attack. And that's why you have this whole incredible underground area, which today is being excavated and we're discovering all sorts of things. But basically this very special site in Second Temple times, right? The main street that ran along the Temple Mount becomes the basements of the homes of the Muslim quarter. And that's the picture that you see here. This is from where a cistern underneath the Temple Mount. But they also build religious buildings, which today have been turned into synagogues. We do the same kind of thing, and not as bad, but we do it sometimes. And finally, we have discovered all kinds of incredible things because these arches protected what was underneath. So since the 70s, 80s, with the incredible Western Wall Tunnels excavation project, which is still going on, they're still finding unbelievable things. We're uncovering the main street of the city from Herodian times, all kinds of mikvaot, plus many other structures from different time periods. So it really preserved a lot of the city. Finally, let's talk about the Jews and the Crusades for a moment. The Crusades have an impact everywhere, obviously on a physical level, like what we said, right? Unfortunately, these terrible attacks and massacres, particularly in Europe, but also on a spiritual level. Here you have this Christian army that are literally going out with an enormous cross on them, and they are going out and proclaiming the righteousness of their cause. And Jews have to counter that in some way. And that's why you have these stories, which are very, very disturbing when we read them and when we hear them, about this terrible suicide, which you really don't have in pretty much any other time of Jewish history, perhaps in the Holocaust, where Jews, rather than converting, choose to commit suicide, choose to murder their children. And we have these really spine-tingling, terrible stories of mothers and fathers who murder all their children rather than allow them to convert to Christianity or be forced to convert to Christianity. And the rabbis talk about this, right? Was this a good choice? Was this the right thing to do? But there is a feeling of a religious war. The Crusaders may have believed they're in a religious war with the Muslims, but the Jews are looking at it and saying, well, you guys might have the military strength, but we are the ones who are the chosen people. And that's why many people interpret the first Rashi in the Torah, right? Last week's Parsha, very, very beginning, right? Rashi asks this question, Rabbi Yitzchak asks the question, why are we starting the Torah with creation? Which the Ramban says, well, that's a strange question, but we won't address that now. Why don't we start the Torah with the mitzvot, with the commandments? Why do we start with the whole story of creation? So if you look in the middle here, for what reason did he commence within the beginning? Because of the verse, right, the verse in Tehillim, the strength of his works he related to his people, koch masav igid la'amo, latet lahem nachlak goyim, to give them the inheritance of the nation. For if the nations of the world should say to Israel, you are robbers, for you conquered by force the land of the seven nations, they will reply, the entire earth belongs to the Holy One, blessed be he. He created it and gave it to whoever he deemed proper. When he wished, he gave it to them. And when he wished, he took it away from them and gave it to us. It's very difficult to read this without understanding that Rashi is talking about the Crusaders gathering to take the land from the Muslims. No, the land doesn't belong to you and it doesn't belong to you. It belongs to God, and God is going to give it back to us. But finally, we have this strange phenomenon, which I talked about at the beginning, and we'll talk about it again when we talk about the Ramban, of the land of Israel opening up and more people coming back, Jews coming back to the land. And one of the most famous ones, of course, is the Ramban, Nachmanides. And he writes this very, very pregnant commentary. It's very famous, right? It takes the verse in the book of Vayikra and Leviticus, I will bring the land to desolation. This is in the curses, and your enemies that dwell there shall be astonished at it. And Ramban says in these words, promise redemption more than any of the visions of Daniel. When it says your enemies will be astonished by it, this is good news, informing us our land cannot accept our enemies. And this is a great proof and promise, because you cannot find another land as fertile and prosperous that is now so destroyed. Because since we have left it, it has not accepted any nation or language. All try to settle it and cannot succeed. And this is the Ramban coming to the land, seeing these very powerful rulers in the land and saying, you know what? This land ultimately is going to come back to us, to the Jewish people. So Let's stop sharing and take a look at questions. Yes. Okay. And people can unmute themselves if they want. Let's see what questions we have here. When did the Jews return? We talked about this. Hadrian expelled, right. They left Jerusalem, but they come back. And in fact, the Muslims are the ones who allow the Jews to settle again in Jerusalem. The woman in Pekin does not have children. I see somebody answered that already. Yes, people have blue eyes because they married with the locals. They traveled via Constantinople, but that was not the main purpose, and it was not how they recruited everybody. Okay, the emperor moved to Anatolia as fast as possible. They moved south and east. Okay, right. They moved on. They didn't stay. How did the Crusades affect population in Europe? That's a very good question. I do not know, but we do have the Black Death that happens, 100 years later, which completely decimates the population. I don't know how much the Crusades affect the population. It's an interesting question. I do not know the answer. Sorry. The stork makes the sound of lock lock. Very nice. The Crusaders build on the Temple Mount. Okay. They build, they don't do anything to the foundation stone, but they do build on the Temple Mount. And that, of course, is gotten rid of by the Muslims. Saladin was a Kurd. Thank you. I'm very bad about
that. They actually cut away pieces of the rock and sell it.
Okay. I did not know that. Thank you. Who said that? I don't see who that is.
Rivka Esther.
Hi. Thank you, Rivka Esther. Okay. No, the Crusaders don't kill the Eastern Orthodox Christians. They're part of the story. Okay. The Mamluks were celibate? No. Some of them are, but no. They have, we'll see when we talk about Jerusalem. They have very interesting rules about inheritance, and that has a big effect on Jerusalem's building, but they have children. Akko was destroyed, but not destroyed as in razed to the ground. What happens in Akko is fascinating. Okay. The Crusaders are kicked out. They knock down, some things, but not everything. It's much too massive to really destroy. But what happens is that hundreds of years later, at the end of the 18th century, along comes this Arab ruler, Dar al-Omar, Muslim ruler, Dar al-Omar. And what he does is there's no bulldozers, right? It's a very important idea in the ancient world. There are no bulldozers. I know that sounds stupid, but it's important. You cannot clear away the ruins of these massive, massive buildings. So again, he also builds huge arches and builds another city 12 meters, 36 feet above the first city. And then from the 50s and on of the 20th century, we excavate that first city, the Crusader city. It's preserved underneath. The invaders, they probably did use local labor because there was no way that they had enough labor. Okay, my presentation is saved on Torah in Motion site, so you can go there. How does Baibars raise the Muslim quarter? What he does is he builds these, they're called superstructures, right? These massive arches that are like a foundation, and then he builds the buildings on top, right? Does that make sense? Go to the Kotel tunnels and they'll tell you even more. Okay. Thank you, everyone. Rabbi Kalman did the coming attraction, so I have no coming attraction, so you can all look on the site if you don't remember, or if you came
late.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Next
week,
we'll go to
Tveria. How do we get your timeline?
I can send the timeline and the quote from the last slide to Rabbi Kalman, and I'll have him put it on the site, okay? Mm. Is that good?
Thank you.
I will send it to him, and he will upload it. Thank you, everyone. I'm ending the meeting because Rabbi Kalman is not here. So bye. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. Wow.
Thank you.
Thank you.